Says, in representing a client, a lawyer shall not communicate about the subject of the representation with a person the lawyer knows to be represented by a counsel in by another lawyer in the matter. And I want to look at that in last part real close, because this is where it gets you into trouble. Unless the lawyer has the consent of the other lawyer or is authorized by law or a court order to do so. Notice what's missing from there. It doesn't say the other person consents to the contact. And the paper has things where the other side calls me up and says, hey, I've been trying to settle this. I really want to settle this. My lawyer won't talk to you. You have to say, I'm sorry, I cannot talk to you. Oh, I consent. I'll sign anything you want. I cannot talk to you. You're represented by counsel. I have to get that permission from your lawyer. The way this comes into play that sometimes interferes with our other obligations is if I'm doing pre-suit investigation. And I'll give you an example of that, which, frankly, I find kind of shocking. I'm trying to figure out if somebody's selling knockoffs. So I want to send somebody in to buy the knockoffs in a trademark case, for example. Well, if they come in and they say, you know, hey, we're thinking about suing you guys for selling knockoffs. Do you sue them? You're not going to get the evidence you need. And yet there are courts that have interpreted this rule to apply because a matter exists at that point. And as we'll see in the next slide, the person who's saying, yes, we and their knockoffs, that person is making an admission that can bind their employer. And so we'll see how they are represented by counsel. So this can interfere with your obligation to do a pre-suit investigation because a matter can exist before a lawsuit is filed. Now, if you're negotiating something, then you have a matter. You know, the other side has a matter, and it may be that they have counsel in that matter. So now, who is represented by this? And this is the part of the rule I think that gets lawyers in trouble the most. So if Bob is on the other side and Bob has a lawyer, we're done, right? Bob is a human being. But what if it's Bob Incorporated? Who at Bob Incorporated is represented by the company's lawyer? And there's three categories, and they vary a little bit by state, and I'll talk about the example that's different. So now notice, the rule could be, if I sue Bob Incorporated, everybody at Bob Incorporated is represented by their lawyer. Or it could be that nobody is, because the lawyer technically represents the entity and nobody in it. I mean, that's the way we look at it for conflicts purposes. Instead, they create three categories of current employees who are deemed to be represented by the company's lawyer. These people may have never talked to the lawyer, may not even know the matter exists, but they are, quote unquote, represented by the company's lawyer. One is somebody, and this makes sense, right? This person supervises or directs or consults with, and this is inside or outside counsel. Cool, that makes sense. A constituent has authority to obligate the organization with respect to the matter. Some states say that means if they can make an admission, like, yes, we sell products in this district, just an admission that would bind the organization are within that. But that other, you know, high-level folks, that makes sense. But notice they're not actually interacting with the lawyer. They're just folks who can make statements that would obligate the organization. And look at this last one, and, you know, put aside patent practice for a little while. Somebody who's driving a forklift that hurts somebody is represented by counsel in the matter, even if they don't know there's a lawsuit. They don't know anything about it, and they've not talked to the lawyer because their act or omission can be imputed to the entity for purposes of civil or criminal liability. So that's a huge category of people who are, quote unquote, represented by the lawyer on the other side, who you may not intuitively think are within the scope of that prohibition. Who's outside of it? Well, all the other current employees. All former employees, but you got to be careful. Someone earlier today talked about work product and privilege with former employees. But as to them, now they're in the other category. You know, so if I'm going to talk to somebody who's not in management, they don't talk to them lately, and they're not somebody whose act or omission is imputed to the organization, I need to say, hey, my name's David Risick, and I'm about to sue your company. Hello? Hello? Right? They're going to hang up as soon as I say, I'm about to sue your current employer. I want to look for the disgruntled former employee, because then they're more likely to say, yeah, let me tell you about what we were doing. We were robbing and stealing at the time. So there's a huge category of people who are covered by this rule that aren't intuitively so. And the paper goes into a lot of different scenarios that when you read the cases, you're like, well, that's just really wrong. But You know, I'm not a federal judge, so I can't do anything about it. But in pre-suit investigations, in false advertising cases, patent cases, trademark cases, during litigation or transaction when a lawyer communicates directly with opposing client, and I'll show you an example of that, and you're going to be like, no way. And I'm going to say, way. When a lawyer, now look at this for a second. So I'm allowed to let my client know they can talk to the other side. Principal-to-principal communication is perfectly acceptable. And I'm supposed to represent my client competently. So they can talk to the other side. Now, I can't, right? If they're represented by a lawyer, I can't communicate with them. Can I coach my client? Can I say, you know, here's what you ought to ask about, or here's the concerns we have? Or am I using my client to do something that I can't do? And I'll show you the cases dealing with that issue, because I don't think they make sense. This is a recent case out of the Southern District of New York. So, okay, I talk to somebody and I discover the other side has committed perjury. Everybody with me on that? I find out the other side has committed perjury. I get sanctioned, not the other side. Here's what happens. So the patentee sues this defendant. And they move to dismiss. They say there's no personal jurisdiction. Here's a sworn statement. We got no offices. We don't sell any products in the Southern District of New York. The lawyers, what they do is the patentee's counsel, they go to a trade show. They walk up to some low-level defendants, employees, and they say, hey, y'all have an office here or sell anything here? And they say, yes, we do. So, perjury, right? We got a false sworn affidavit. What do these lawyers do? They use that evidence in an affidavit to oppose the motion, and they say, Judge, those other guys lied to you in court. We have a recording that we made of their employees saying, of course we have an office here. It's down the block.